This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to find out how you can volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. The Peloponnesian War, by Thucydides, translated by Richard Crawley. Book 4, Chapter 12. Next summer, about the time of the corn's coming into ear, 10 Syracusan and as many Locrian vessels sailed to Messina in Sicily and occupied the town upon the invitation of the inhabitants, and Messina revolted from the Athenians. The Syracusans contrived this chiefly because they saw that the place afforded an approach to Sicily and feared that the Athenians might hereafter use it as a base for attacking them with a larger force, the Locrians because they wished to carry on hostilities from both sides of the strait and to reduce their enemies, the people of Rhegium. Meanwhile, the Locrians had invaded the Rhegian territory with all their forces, to prevent their succoring Messina, and also at the instance of some exiles from Rhegium who were with them, the long factions by which that town had been torn rendering it for the moment incapable of resistance, and thus furnishing an additional temptation to the invaders. After devastating the country, the Locrian land forces retired, their ships remaining to guard Messina, while others were being manned for the same destination to carry on the war from thence. About the same time in the spring, before the corn was ripe, the Peloponnesians and their allies invaded Attica under Agis, the son of Archidamus, king of the Lacedaemonians, and sat down and laid waste the country. Meanwhile, the Athenians sent off the 40 ships which they had been preparing to Sicily, with the remaining generals Eurymedon and Sophocles, their colleague Pythodorus having already proceeded from thither. These had also instructions as they sailed, to look to the Corcyraeans in the town who were being plundered by the exiles in the mountains. To support these exiles, 60 Peloponnesian vessels had lately sailed, it being thought that the famine raging in the city would make it easy for them to reduce it. Demosthenes also, who had remained without employment since his return from Acarnania, applied and obtained permission to use the fleet, if he wished it, upon the coast of Peloponnese. Off Laconia, they heard that the Peloponnesian ships were already at Corcyra, upon which Eurymedon and Sophocles wished to hasten to the island, but Demosthenes required them first to touch at Pylos, and do what was wanted there, before continuing their voyage. While they were making objections, a squall chanced to come on and carried the fleet into Pylos. Demosthenes at once urged them to fortify the place, it being for this that he had come on voyage, and made them observe that there was plenty of stone and timber on the spot, and that the place was strong by nature, and together with much of the country round unoccupied. Pylos, or Coryphasium, as the Lacedaemonians call it, being about 45 miles distant from Sparta, and situated in the old country of the Messenians. The commanders told him that there was no lack of desert headlands in Peloponnese if he wished to put the city to expense by occupying them. He, however, thought that this place was distinguished from others of the kind by having a harbor close by, while the Messenians, the old natives of the country, speaking the same dialect as the Lacedaemonians, could do them the greatest mischief by their incursions from it, and would at the same time be a trusty garrison. After speaking to the captains of companies on the subject and failing to persuade either the generals or the soldiers, he remained inactive with the rest from stress of weather, until the soldiers themselves, wanting occupation, were seized with a sudden impulse to go round and fortify the place. Accordingly, they set to work in earnest, and having no iron tools, picked up stones and put them together as they happened to fit, and where mortar was needed, carried it on their backs, for want of hods, stooping down to make it stay on, and clasping their hands together behind to prevent it falling off, sparing no effort to be able to complete the most vulnerable points before the arrival of the Lacedaemonians, most of the place being sufficiently strong by nature without further fortifications. Meanwhile, the Lacedaemonians were celebrating a festival, and also at first made light of the news, in the idea that whenever they chose to take the field, the place would be immediately evacuated by the enemy, or easily taken by force, the absence of their army before Athens having also something to do with their delay. The Athenians fortified the place on the land side, and where it most required it, in 6 days, and leaving Demosthenes with 5 ships to garrison it, with the main body of the fleet, hastened on their voyage to Corcyra and Sicily. As soon as the Peloponnesians in Attica heard of the occupation of Pylos, they hurried back home, the Lacedaemonians and their king Agis thinking that the matter touched them nearly. Besides having made the invasion early in the season, and while the corn was still green, most of their troops were short of provisions. The weather also was unusually bad for the time of year, and greatly distressed their army. Many reasons thus combined to hasten their departure, and to make this invasion a very short one. Indeed, they only stayed 15 days in Attica. About the same time, the Athenian general Simonides, getting together a few Athenians from the garrisons and a number of the allies in those parts, took Aeon in Thrace, a Mendaean colony, and hostile to Athens, by treachery, but had no sooner done so than the Chalcidians and Bodiaeans came up and beat him out of it, with the loss of many of his soldiers. On the return of the Peloponnesians from Attica, the Spartans themselves and the nearest of the Perioeci at once set out for Pylos, the other Lacedaemonians following more slowly, as they had just come in from another campaign. Word was also sent round Peloponnese to come up as quickly as possible to Pylos, while the 60 Peloponnesian ships were sent for from Corcyra, and being dragged by their crews across the Isthmus of Leucas, passed unperceived by the Athenian squadrons at Zacynthus, and reached Pylos, where the land forces had arrived before them. Before the Peloponnesian fleet sailed in, Demosthenes found time to send out unobserved two ships to inform Eurymedon and the Athenians on board the fleet at Zacynthus of the danger of Pylos, and to summon them to his assistance. While the ships hastened on their voyage in obedience to the orders of Demosthenes, the Lacedaemonians prepared to assault the fort by land and sea, hoping to capture with ease a work constructed in haste and held by a feeble garrison. Meanwhile, as they expected, the Athenian ships to arrive from Zacynthus, they intended, if they failed to take the place before, to block up the entrances of the harbor to prevent their being able to anchor inside it. For the island of Sphacteria, stretching along in a line close to the front of the harbor, at once makes it safe and narrows its entrances, leaving a passage for two ships on the side nearest Pylos and the Athenian fortifications, and for 8 or 9 on that next the rest of the mainland. For the rest, the island was entirely covered with wood and without paths through not being inhabited, and about 1 mile and 5 furlongs in length. The inlets the Lacedaemonians meant to close with a line of ships placed close together, with their prows turned toward the sea, and meanwhile, fearing that the enemy might make use of the island to operate against them, carried over some heavy infantry thither, stationing others along the coast. By this means the island and the continent would be alike hostile to the Athenians, as they would be unable to land on either, and the shore of Pylos itself outside the inlet toward the open sea having no harbor, and therefore presenting no point which they could use as a base to relieve their countrymen, they, the Lacedaemonians, without sea fight or risk, would in all probability become masters of the place, occupied as it had been on the spur of the moment and unfurnished with provisions. This being determined, they carried over to the island the heavy infantry, drafted by lot from all the companies. Some others had crossed over before in relief parties, but these last who were left there were 420 in number, with their Helot attendants, commanded by Epitadas, son of Molobrus. Meanwhile, Demosthenes, seeing the Lacedaemonians about to attack him by sea and land at once, himself was not idle. He drew up under the fortification, and enclosed in a stockade the galleys remaining to him of those which had been left him, arming the sailors taken out of them with poor shields, made most of them from osier, it being impossible to procure arms in such a desert place, and even these having been obtained from a 30-oared Messenian privateer, and a boat belonging to some Messenians who happened to have come to them. Among these Messenians were 40 heavy infantry, whom he made use of with the rest. Posting most of his men, unarmed and armed, upon the best fortified and strong points of the place towards the interior, with orders to repel any attack of the land forces, he picked 60 heavy infantry and a few archers from his whole force, and with these went outside the wall down to the sea, where he thought that the enemy would most likely attempt to land. Although the ground was difficult and rocky, looking towards the open sea, the fact that this was the weakest part of the wall would, he thought, encourage their ardor, as the Athenians, confident in their naval superiority, had here paid little attention to their defenses, and the enemy, if he could force a landing, might feel secure of taking the place. At this point, accordingly, going down to the water's edge, he posted his heavy infantry to prevent it, if possible, a landing, and encouraged them in the following terms. "Soldiers and comrades in this adventure, I hope that none of you in our present strait will think to show his wit by exactly calculating all the perils that encompass us, but that you will rather hasten to close with the enemy without staying to count the odds, seeing in this your best chance of safety. In emergencies like ours, calculation is out of place. The sooner the danger is faced, the better. To my mind also, most of the chances are for us, if we will only stand fast and not throw away our advantages, overawed by the numbers of the enemy. One of the points in our favor is the awkwardness of the landing. This, however, only helps us if we stand our ground. If we give way, it will be practicable enough, in spite of its natural difficulty, without a defender, and the enemy will instantly become more formidable from the difficulty he will have in retreating, supposing that we succeed in repulsing him, which we shall find it easier to do while he is on board his ships than after he has landed and meets us on equal terms. As to his numbers, these need not too much alarm you. Large as they may be, he can only engage in small detachments, from the impossibility of bringing two. Besides, the numerical superiority that we have to meet is not that of an army on land with everything else equal, but of troops on board ship, upon an element where many favorable accidents are required to act with effect. I therefore consider that his difficulties may be fairly set against our numerical deficiencies, and at the same time I charge you, as Athenians who know by experience what landing from ships on hostile territory means, and how impossible it is to drive back an enemy determined enough to stand his ground, and not to be frightened away by the surf and the terrors of the ships sailing in, to stand fast in this present emergency, beat back the enemy at the water's edge, and save yourselves, and the place. Thus encouraged by Demosthenes, the Athenians felt more confident and went down to meet the enemy, posting themselves along the edge of the sea. The Lacedaemonians now put themselves in movement and simultaneously assaulted the fortifications with their land forces and with their ships, 43 in number, under their admiral, Thrasymelidas, son of Cratesicles, a Spartan who made his attack just where Demosthenes expected. The Athenians had thus to defend themselves on both sides, from the land and from the sea, the enemy rowing up in small detachments, the one relieving the other, it being impossible for many to bring two at once, and showing great ardor in cheering each other on in the endeavor to force a passage and to take the fortification. He who most distinguished himself was Brasidas, captain of a galley, and seeing that the captains and steersmen, impressed by the difficulty of the position, hung back even where a landing might have seemed possible for fear of wrecking their vessels, he shouted out to them that they must never allow the enemy to fortify themselves in their country for the sake of saving timber, but must shiver their vessels and force a landing, and bade the allies, instead of hesitating in such a moment, to sacrifice their ships for Lacedaemon in return for her many benefits, to run them boldly aground, land in one way or another, and make themselves master of the place and its garrison. Not content with this exhortation, he forced his own steersman to run his ship ashore, and stepping onto the gangway was endeavoring to land when he was cut down by the Athenians, and after receiving many wounds fainted away. Falling into the bows, his shield slipped off his arm into the sea, and being thrown ashore was picked up by the Athenians, and afterwards used for the trophy which they set up for this attack. The rest also did their best, but were not able to land owing to the difficulty of the ground and the unflinching tenacity of the Athenians. It was a strange reversal of the order of things for Athenians to be fighting from the land, and from Laconian land, too, against Lacedaemonians coming from the sea, while Lacedaemonians were trying to land from shipboard in their own country, now become hostile, to attack Athenians, although the former were chiefly famous at that time as an inland people and superior by land, the latter as a maritime people with a navy that had no equal. After continuing their attacks during that day and most of the next, the Peloponnesians desisted, and the day after sent some of their ships to Asine for timber to make engines, hoping to take by their aid, in spite of its height, the wall opposite the harbor, where the landing was easiest. At this moment the Athenian fleet from Zakynthos arrived, now numbering 50 sail, having been reinforced by some of the ships on guard at Naupactus, and by 4 Chian vessels. Seeing the coast and the island both crowded with heavy infantry, and the hostile ships in harbor showing no signs of sailing out, at a loss where to anchor, they sailed for the moment to the desert island of Prote, not far off where they passed the night. The next day they got under way in readiness to engage in the open sea if the enemy chose to put out to meet them, being determined in the event of his not doing so to sail in and attack him. The Lacedaemonians did not put out to sea, and having omitted to close the inlets as they had intended, remained quiet on shore, engaged in manning their ships, and getting ready, in case of anyone sailing in, to fight in the harbor, which is a fairly large one. Perceiving this, the Athenians advanced against them by each inlet, and falling on the enemy's fleet, most of which was by this time afloat and in line, at once put it to flight, and giving chase as far as the short distance allowed, disabled a good many vessels, and took 5, one with its crew on board, dashing in at the rest that had taken refuge on shore, and battering some that were still being manned before they could put out, and lashing onto their own ships, and towing off empty others whose crews had fled. At this sight the Lacedaemonians, maddened by a disaster which cut off their men on the island, rushed to the rescue, and going into the sea with their heavy armor, laid hold of the ships and tried to drag them back, each man thinking that success depended on his individual exertions. Great was the melee, and great in contradiction to the naval tactics usual to the two combatants, the Lacedaemonians in their excitement and dismay being actually engaged in a sea fight on land, while the victorious Athenians, in their eagerness to push their success as far as possible, were carrying on a land fight from their ships. After great exertions and numerous wounds on both sides, they separated, the Lacedaemonians saving their empty ships except those first taken, and both parties returning to their camps. The Athenians set up a trophy, gave back the dead, secured the wrecks, and at once began to cruise round and jealously watch the island, with its intercepted garrison, while the Peloponnesians on the mainland, whose contingents had now all come up, stayed where they were before Pylos. When the news of what had happened at Pylos reached Sparta, the disaster was thought so serious that the Lacedaemonians resolved that the authorities should go down to the camp and decide on the spot what was best to be done. There, seeing that it was impossible to help their men, and not wishing to risk their being reduced by hunger or overpowered by numbers, they determined, with the consent of the Athenian generals, to conclude an armistice at Pylos and send envoys to Athens to obtain a convention, and to endeavor to get back their men as quickly as possible. The generals accepting their offers, an armistice was concluded upon the terms following: that the Lacedaemonians should bring to Pylos and deliver up to the Athenians the ships that had fought in the late engagement, and all in Laconia that were vessels of war, and should make no attack on the fortification, either by land or by sea. That the Athenians should allow the Lacedaemonians on the mainland to send the men in the island a certain fixed quantity of corn ready kneaded, that is to say, 2 quarts of barley meal, 1 pint of wine, and a piece of meat for each man, and half the same quantity for a servant. That this allowance should be sent in under the eyes of the Athenians, and that no boat should sail to the island except openly. That the Athenians should continue to the island same as before, without, however, landing upon it, and should refrain from attacking the Peloponnesian troops either by land or by sea. That if either party should infringe any of these terms in the slightest particular, the armistice should be at once void. That the armistice should hold good until the return of the Lacedaemonian envoys from Athens, the Athenians sending them thither in a galley and bringing them back again, and upon the arrival of the envoys should be at an end, and the ships be restored by the Athenians in the same state as they received them. Such were the terms of the armistice, and the ships were delivered over to the number of 60, and the envoys sent off accordingly. Arrived at Athens, they spoke as follows: Athenians, the Lacedaemonians sent us to try to find some way of settling the affair of our men on the island that shall at once be satisfactory to our interests, and as consistent with our dignity and our misfortune as circumstances permit. We can venture to speak at some length without any departure from the habit of our country. Men of few words where many are not wanted, we can be less brief when there is a matter of importance to be illustrated, and an end to be served by its illustration. Meanwhile, we beg you to take what we may say, not in a hostile spirit, nor as if we thought you ignorant and wished to lecture you, but rather as a suggestion on the best course to be taken, addressed to intelligent judges. You can now, if you choose, employ your present success to advantage, so as to keep what you have got and gain honor and reputation besides, and you can avoid the mistake of those who meet with an extraordinary piece of good fortune, and are led on by hope to grasp continually at something further, through having already succeeded without expecting it. While those who have known most vicissitudes of good and bad have also justly least faith in their prosperity, and to teach your city and ours this lesson, experience has not been wanting. To be convinced of this, you have only to look at our present misfortune. What power in Hellas stood higher than we did, and yet we are come to you, although we formerly thought ourselves more able to grant what we are now here to ask. Nevertheless, we have not been brought to this by any decay in our power, or through having our heads turned by aggrandizement. No, our resources are what they have always been, and our error has been an error of judgment, to which all are equally liable. Accordingly, the prosperity which your city now enjoys, and the accession that it has lately received, must not make you fancy that fortune will always be with you. Indeed, sensible men are prudent enough to treat their gains as precarious, just as they would also keep a clear head in adversity, and think that war, so far from staying within the limit to which a combatant may wish to confine it, will run the course that its chances prescribe. And thus, not being puffed up by confidence in military success, they are less likely to come to grief, and most ready to make peace, if they can, while their fortune lasts. This, Athenians, you have a good opportunity to do now with us, and thus to escape the possible disasters which may follow upon your refusal, and the consequent imputation of having owed to accident even your present advantages, when you might have left behind you a reputation for power and wisdom which nothing could endanger. The Lacedaemonians accordingly invite you to make a treaty and to end the war, and offer peace and alliance and the most friendly and intimate relations in every way and on every occasion between us, and in return ask for the men on the island. thinking it better for both parties not to stand out to the end, on the chance of some favorable accident enabling the men to force their way out, or of their being compelled to succumb under the pressure of blockade. Indeed, if great enmities are ever to be really settled, we think it will be not by the system of revenge and military success, and by forcing an opponent to swear to a treaty to his disadvantage, but when the more fortunate combatant waives these his privileges, to be guided by gentler feelings, conquers his rival in generosity, and accords peace on more moderate conditions than he expected. From that moment, instead of the debt of revenge which violence must entail, his adversary owes a debt of generosity to be paid in kind, and is inclined by honor to stand to his agreement. And men oftener act in this manner towards their greatest enemies than where the quarrel is of less importance. They are also by nature as glad to give way to those who first yield to them, as they are apt to be provoked by arrogance to risks condemned by their own judgment. To apply this to ourselves, if peace was ever desirable for both parties, it is surely so at the present moment, before anything irremediable befall us and force us to hate you eternally, personally as well as politically, and you to miss the advantages that we now offer you. While the issue is still in doubt and you have reputation in our friendship in prospect, and we the compromise of our misfortune before anything fatal occur, let us be reconciled, and for ourselves choose peace instead of war, and grant to the rest of Hellenes a remission from their sufferings, for which be sure they will think they have chiefly you to thank. The war that they labor under they know not which began, but the peace that concludes it, as it depends on your decision, will by their gratitude be laid at your door. By such a decision you can become firm friends with the Lacedaemonians at their own invitation, which you do not force from them, but oblige them by accepting. And from this friendship consider the advantages that are likely to follow. When Attica and Sparta are at one, the rest of Hellas, be sure, will remain in respectful inferiority before its heads. Such were the words of the Lacedaemonians, their idea being that the Athenians, already desirous of a truce, and only kept back by their opposition, would joyfully accept a peace freely offered and give back the men. The Athenians, however, having the men on the island, thought that the treaty would be ready for them whenever they chose to make it, and grasped at something further. Foremost, to encourage them in this policy was Cleon, son of Cleonetus, a popular leader of the time and very powerful with the multitude, who persuaded them to answer as follows. First, the men in the island must surrender themselves and their arms and be brought to Athens. Next, the Lacedaemonians must restore Nicaea, Pegae, Troezen, and Achaea, all places acquired not by arms, but by the previous convention, under which they had been ceded by Athens herself at a moment of disaster, when a truce was more necessary to her than at present. This done, they might take back their men and make a truce for as long as both parties might agree. To this answer the envoys made no reply, but asked that commissioners might be chosen with whom they might confer on each point, and quietly talk the matter over and try to come to some agreement. Hereupon Cleon violently assailed them, saying that he knew from the first that they had no right intentions, and that it was clear enough now by their refusing to speak before the people and wanting to confer in secret with a committee of two or three. No, if they meant anything honest, let them say it out before all. The Lacedaemonians, however, seeing that whatever concessions they might be prepared to make in their misfortune, it was impossible for them to speak before the multitude and lose credit with their allies for a negotiation which might, after all, miscarry, and on the other hand, that the Athenians would never grant what they asked upon moderate terms, returned from Athens without having effected anything. Their arrival at once put an end to the armistice at Pylos, and the Lacedaemonians asked back their ships according to the convention. The Athenians, however, alleged an attack on the fort in contravention of the truce, and other grievances seemingly not worth mentioning, and refused to give them back, insisting upon the clause by which the slightest infringement made the armistice void. The Lacedaemonians, after denying the contravention and protesting against their bad faith in the matter of the ships, went away and earnestly addressed themselves to the war. Hostilities were now carried on at Pylos upon both sides with vigor. The Athenians cruised round the island all day with two ships going different ways, and by night, except on the seaward side in windy weather, anchored round it with their whole fleet, which, having been reinforced by 20 ships from Athens come to aid in the blockade, now numbered 70 sail, while the Peloponnesians remained encamped on the continent, making attacks on the fort, and on the lookout for any opportunity which might offer itself for the deliverance of their men. Meanwhile, the Syracusans and their allies in Sicily had brought up to the squadron guarding Messina the reinforcement which we left them preparing, and carried on the war from thence, incited chiefly by the Locrians from hatred of the Rhegians, whose territory they had invaded with all their forces. The Syracusans also wished to try their fortune at sea, seeing that the Athenians had only a few ships actually at Rhegium, and hearing that the main fleet destined to join them was engaged in blockading the island. A naval victory, they thought, would enable them to blockade Rhegium by sea and land, and easily to reduce it, a success which would at once place their affairs upon a solid basis, the promontory of Rhegium in Italy and Messina in Sicily being so near each other that it would be impossible for the Athenians to cruise against them and command the strait. The strait in question consists of the sea between Rhegium and Messina, at the point where Sicily approaches nearest to the continent, and is the Charybdis through which the story makes Ulysses sail, and the narrowness of the passage and the strength of the current that pours in from the vast Tyrrhenian and Sicilian mains have rightly given it a bad reputation. In this strait, the Syracusans and their allies were compelled to fight, late in the day, about the passage of a boat, putting out with rather more than 30 ships against 60 Athenians and 8 Rhegian vessels. Defeated by the Athenians, they hastily set off, each for himself, to their own stations at Messina and Rhegium, with the loss of one ship, night coming on before the battle was finished. After this, the Locrians retired from the Rhegian territory, and the ships of the Syracusans and their allies united and came to anchor at Cape Pelorus, in the territory of Messina, where their land forces joined them. Here the Athenians and Rhegians sailed up, and seeing the ships unmanned, made an attack, in which they in turn lost one vessel, which was caught by a grappling iron, the crew saving themselves by swimming. After this, the Syracusans got on board their ships, and while they were being towed along shore to Messina, were again attacked by the Athenians, but suddenly got out to sea and became the assailants, and caused them to lose another vessel. After thus holding their own in the voyage along shore, and in the engagement as above described, the Syracusans sailed on into the harbor of Messina. Meanwhile, the Athenians, having received warning that Camarina was about to be betrayed to the Syracusans by Archias and his party, sailed thither, and the Messinese took this opportunity to attack by sea and land, with all their forces, their Chalcidian neighbor Naxos. The first day they forced the Naxians to keep their walls and laid waste their country. The next they sailed round with their ships and laid waste the land on the river Acesines, while their land forces menaced the city. Meanwhile, the Sicels came down from the high country in great numbers to aid against the Messinese, and the Naxians, elated at the sight and animated by a belief that the Leontines and their other Hellenic allies were coming to their support, suddenly sallied out from the town and attacked and routed the Messinese, killing more than 1,000 of them, while the remainder suffered severely in their retreat home, being attacked by the barbarians on the road, and most of them cut off. The ships put into Messina and afterwards dispersed for their different homes. The Leontines and their allies, with the Athenians, upon this at once turned their arms against the now weakened Messina and attacked, the Athenians with their ships on the one side of the harbor and the land forces on that of the town. The Messinese, however, sallying out with Demoteles and some Locrians who had been left to garrison the city after the disaster, suddenly attacked and routed most of the Leontine army, killing a great number, upon seeing which the Athenians landed from their ships and falling on the Messinese in disorder, chased them back into the town, and setting up a trophy, retired to Rhegium. After this, the Hellenes in Sicily continued to make war on each other by land, without the Athenians. Meanwhile, the Athenians at Pylos were still besieging the Lacedaemonians in the island, the Peloponnesian forces on the continent remaining where they were. The blockade was very laborious from the Athenians for want of food and water. There was no spring except one in the citadel at Pylos itself, and that not a large one. And most of them were obliged to grub up the shingle on the sea beach and drink such water as they could find. They also suffered from want of room, being encamped in a narrow space, and as there was no anchorage for the ships, some took their meals on shore in their turn, while the others were anchored out at sea. But their greatest discouragement arose from the unexpectedly long time which it took to reduce a body of men shut up in a desert island, with only brackish water to drink, a matter which they had imagined would take them only a few days. The fact was that the Lacedaemonians had made an advertisement for volunteers to carry into the island ground corn, wine, cheese, and any other food useful in a siege, high prices being offered, and freedom promised to any of the Helots who should succeed in doing so. The Helots, accordingly, were most forward to engage in this risky traffic, putting off from this or that part of Peloponnese, and running in by night on the seaward side of the island. They were best pleased, however, when they could catch a wind to carry them in. It was more easy to elude the lookouts of the galleys when it blew from the seaward, as it became impossible for them to anchor round the island, while the Helots had their boats rated at their value in money, and ran them ashore, without caring how they landed, being sure to find the soldiers waiting for them at the landing places. But all who risked it in fair weather were taken. Divers also swam in underwater from the harbor, dragging by a cord in skins, poppy seed mixed with honey, and bruised linseed. These at first escaped notice, but afterwards a lookout was kept for them. In short, both sides tried every possible contrivance, the one to throw in provisions, the other to prevent their introduction. At Athens, meanwhile, the news that the army was in great distress, and that corn found its way into the men on the island, caused no small perplexity, and the Athenians began to fear that winter might come on and find them still engaged in the blockade. They saw that the convoying of provisions round Peloponnese would then be impossible. The country offered no resources in itself, and even in summer they could not send round enough. The blockade of a place without harbors could no longer be kept up, and the men would either escape by the siege being abandoned, or would watch for bad weather and sail out in the boats that brought in their corn. What caused still more alarm was the attitude of the Lacedaemonians, who must, it was thought by the Athenians, feel themselves on strong ground not to send them any more envoys, and they began to repent having rejected the treaty. Cleon, perceiving the disfavor with which he was regarded for having stood in the way of the convention, now said that their informants did not speak the truth, and upon the messengers recommending them, if they did not believe them, to send some commissioners to see. Cleon himself and Theogenes were chosen by the Athenians as commissioners. Aware that he would now be obliged either to say what had been already said by the men whom he was slandering, or be proved a liar if he said the contrary, he told the Athenians, whom he saw to be not altogether disinclined for a fresh expedition, that instead of sending and wasting their time and opportunities, if they believed what was told them, they ought to sail against the men. And pointing at Nicias, son of Niceratus, then general, whom he hated, he tauntingly said that it would be easy, if they had men for generals, to sail with a force and take those in the island, and that if he had himself been in command, he would have done it. Nicias, seeing the Athenians murmuring against Cleon for not sailing now if it seemed to him so easy, and further seeing himself the object of attack, told him that for all the generals cared, he might take what force he chose and make the attempt. At first Cleon fancied that this resignation was merely a figure of speech, and was ready to go, but finding that it was seriously meant, he drew back and said that Nicias, not he, was general, being now frightened, and having never supposed that Nicias would go so far as to retire in his favor. Nicias, however, repeated his offer, and resigned the command against Pylos, and called the Athenians to witness that he did so. And as the multitude is wont to do, the more Cleon shrank from the expedition and tried to back out of what he had said, the more they encouraged Nicias to hand over his command, and clamored at Cleon to go. At last, not knowing how to get out of his words, he undertook the expedition, and came forward and said that he was not afraid of the Lacedaemonians, but would sail without taking anyone from the city with him, except the Lemnians and Imbrians that were at Athens, with some targeteers that had come up from Aeneas, and 400 archers from other quarters. With these and the soldiers at Pylos, he would within 20 days either bring the Lacedaemonians alive or kill them on the spot. The Athenians could not help laughing at this fatuity, while sensible men comforted themselves with the reflection that they must gain in either circumstance. Either they would be rid of Cleon, which they rather hoped, or, if disappointed in this expectation, would reduce the Lacedaemonians. After he had settled everything in the assembly, and the Athenians had voted him the command of the expedition, he chose as his colleague Demosthenes, one of the generals at Pylos, and pushed forward the preparations for his voyage. His choice fell upon Demosthenes because he heard that he was contemplating a descent on the island. The soldiers, distressed by the difficulties of the position, and rather besieged than besiegers, being eager to fight it out, while the firing of the island had increased the confidence of the general. He had been at first afraid because the island, having never been inhabited, was almost entirely covered with wood and without paths, thinking this to be in the enemy's favor, as he might land with a large force and yet might suffer loss by an attack from an unseen position. The mistakes and forces of the enemy, the wood would be in great measure concealed from him, while every blunder of his own troops would be at once detected, and they would thus be able to fall upon him unexpectedly, just where they pleased, the attack being always in their power. If, on the other hand, he should force them to engage in the thicket, the smaller number who knew the country would, he thought, have advantage over the larger who were ignorant of it, while his own army might be cut off imperceptibly, in spite of its numbers, as the men would not be able to see where to succor each other. The Aetolian disaster, which had been mainly caused by the wood, had not a little to do with these reflections. Meanwhile, one of the soldiers who were compelled by want of room to land on the extremities of the island and take their dinners, with outposts fixed to prevent a surprise, set fire to a little of the wood without meaning to do so, and as it came on to blow soon afterward, almost the whole was consumed before they were aware of it. Demosthenes was now able, for the first time, to see how numerous the Lacedaemonians really were, having up to this moment been under the impression that they took in provisions for a smaller number. He also saw that the Athenians thought success important and were anxious about it, and that it was now easier to land on the island, and accordingly got ready for the attempt, sent for troops from the allies in the neighborhood, and pushed forward his other preparations. At this moment, Cleon arrived in Pylos with the troops which he had asked for, having sent on word to say that he was coming. The first step taken by the two generals after their meeting was to send a herald to the camp on the mainland, and to ask if they were disposed to avoid all risk, and to order the men on the island to surrender themselves and their arms, to be kept in gentle custody until some general convention should be concluded. On the rejection of this proposition, the generals let one day pass, and the next, embarking all their heavy infantry on board a few ships, put out by night, and a little before dawn landed on both sides of the island from the open sea and from the harbor, being about 800 strong, and advanced with a run against the first post in the island. The enemy had distributed his force as follows. In the first post there were about 30 heavy infantry. The center and most level part, where the water was held by the main body, and by Epitadas, their commander, while a small party guarded the very end of the island toward Pylos, which was precipitous on the seaside, and very difficult to attack from the land, and where there was also a sort of old fort of stones rudely put together, which they thought might be useful to them, in case they should be forced to retreat. Such was their disposition. The advance post, thus attacked by the Athenians, was at once put to the sword, the men being scarcely out of bed and still arming, the landing having taken them by surprise, as they fancied the ships were only sailing as usual to their stations for the night. As soon as day broke, the rest of the army landed, that is to say, all the crews of rather more than 70 ships, except the lowest rank of oars, with the arms they carried, 800 archers, and as many targeteers, the Messenian reinforcements, and all the other troops on duty round Pylos, except the garrison of the fort. The tactics of Demosthenes had divided them into companies of 200, more or less, and made them occupy the highest points in order to paralyze the enemy by surrounding him on every side, and thus leaving him, without any tangible adversary, exposed to the crossfire of their host, plied by those in his rear if he attacked in front, and by those on one flank if he moved against those on the other. In short, wherever he went, he would have assailants behind him, and these light-armed assailants the most awkward of all, arrows, darts, stones, and slings making them formidable at a distance, and there being no means of getting at them in close quarters, as they could conquer flying, and the moment their pursuer turned, they were upon him. Such was the idea that inspired Demosthenes in his conception of the descent and presided over its execution. Meanwhile, the main body of the troops in the island, that is, that under Epitadas, seeing their outpost cut off and an army advancing against them, serried their ranks and pressed forward to close with the Athenian heavy infantry in front of them, the light troops being upon their flanks and rear. However, they were not able to engage or profit by their superior skill, the light troops keeping them in check on either side with their missiles, and the heavy infantry remaining stationary instead of advancing to meet them. And although they routed the light troops wherever they ran up and approached too closely, yet they retreated fighting, being lightly equipped, and easily getting the start in their flight, from the difficult and rugged nature of the ground in an island hitherto desert, over which the Lacedaemonians could not pursue them with their heavy armor. After the skirmishing had lasted some little while, the Lacedaemonians became unable to dash out with the same rapidity as before upon the points attacked, and the light troops, finding that they now fought with less vigor, became more confident. They could see with their own eyes that they were many times more numerous than the enemy. They were now more familiar with his aspect, and found him less terrible, the result not having justified the apprehensions which they had suffered when they first landed in slavish dismay at the idea of attacking Lacedaemonians. And accordingly, their fear changing to disdain, they now rushed all together with loud shouts upon them, and pelted them with stones, darts, and arrows, whichever came first to hand. The shouting accompanying their onset confounded the Lacedaemonians, unaccustomed to this mode of fighting. Dust rose from the newly burnt wood, and it was impossible to see in front of one with the arrows and stones flying through clouds of dust from the hands of numerous assailants. The Lacedaemonians had now to sustain a rude conflict. Their caps would not keep out the arrows, darts had broken off in the armor of the wounded, while they themselves were helpless for offense, being prevented from using their eyes to see what was before them, and unable to hear the word of command for the hubbub raised by the enemy. Danger encompassed them on every side, and there was no hope of any means of defense or safety. At last, after many had already been wounded in the confined space in which they were fighting, they formed in close order and retired on the fort at the end of the island, which was not far off, and to their friends who held it. The moment they gave way, the light troops became bolder and pressed upon them, shouting louder than ever, and killed as many as they came up with in their retreat, but most of the Lacedaemonians made good their escape to the fort, and with it the garrison ranged themselves all along its whole extent to repulse the enemy wherever it was assailable. The Athenians pursuing, unable to surround and hem them in owing to the strength of the ground, attacked them in front and tried to storm the position. For a long time indeed, for most of the day, both sides held out against all torments of the battle, thirst and sun, the one endeavoring to drive the enemy from the high ground, the other to maintain himself upon it, it being now more easy for the Lacedaemonians to defend themselves than before, as they could not be surrounded on the flanks. The struggle began to seem endless when the commander of the Messenians came to Cleon and Demosthenes and told them that they were losing their labor, but if they would give him some archers and light troops to go round the enemy's rear by a way he would undertake to find, he thought he could force the approach. Upon receiving what he asked for, he started from a point out of sight in order not to be seen by the enemy, and creeping on wherever the precipices of the island permitted, and where the Lacedaemonians, trusting to the strength of the ground, kept no guard, succeeded after the greatest difficulty in getting round without their seeing him, and suddenly appeared on the high ground in their rear, to the dismay of the surprised enemy, and the still greater joy of his expectant friends. The Lacedaemonians, thus placed between two fires, and in the same dilemma, to compare small things with great, as at Thermopylae, where the defenders were cut off through the Persians getting round the path, being now attacked in front and behind, began to give way, and overcome by the odds against them, and exhausted from want of food, retreated. The Athenians were already masters of the approaches when Cleon and Demosthenes, perceiving that if the enemy gave way a single step further they would be destroyed by their soldiery, put a stop to the battle and held their men back, wishing to take the Lacedaemonians alive to Athens, and hoping that their stubbornness might relax on hearing the offer of terms, and that they might surrender and yield to the present overwhelming danger. Proclamation was accordingly made to know if they would surrender themselves and their arms to the Athenians to be dealt with at their discretion. The Lacedaemonians hearing this offer, most of them lowered their shields and waved their hands to show that they accepted it. Hostilities now ceased, and a parley was held between Cleon and Demosthenes and Stephon, son of Pharax, on the other side, since Epitadas, the first of the previous commanders, had been killed, and Hippagretas, the next in command, left for dead among the slain, though still alive, and thus the command had devolved upon Stephon, according to the law, in case of anything happening to his superiors. Stephon and his companions said they wished to send a herald to the Lacedaemonians on the mainland to know what they were to do. The Athenians would not let any of them go, but themselves called for heralds from the mainland, and after questions had been carried backwards and forwards two or three times, the last men that passed over from the Lacedaemonians on the continent brought this message: "The Lacedaemonians bid you to decide for yourselves, so long as you do nothing dishonorable." Upon which, after consulting together, they surrendered themselves and their arms. The Athenians, after guarding them that day and night, the next morning set up a trophy in the island and got ready to sail, giving their prisoners in batches to be guarded by the captains of the galleys, and the Lacedaemonians sent a herald and took up their dead. The number of the killed and prisoners taken in the island was as follows: 420 heavy infantry passed over, 300 all but 8 were taken alive to Athens, the rest were killed. About 120 of the prisoners were Spartans. The Athenian loss was small, the battle not having been fought at close quarters. The blockade in all, counting from the fight at sea to the battle in the island, had lasted 72 days. For 20 of these, during the absence of the envoys sent to treat for peace, the men had provisions given them, for the rest they were fed by the smugglers. Corn and other victual was found in the island, the commander Epitadas having kept the men upon half rations. The Athenians and Peloponnesians now each withdrew their forces from Pylos and went home, and crazy as Cleon's promise was, he fulfilled it by bringing the men to Athens within the 20 days, as he had pledged himself to do. Nothing that happened in the war surprised the Hellenes so much as this. It was the opinion that no force or famine could make the Lacedaemonians give up their arms, but that they would fight on as they could and die with them in their hands. Indeed, people could scarcely believe that those who had surrendered were of the same stuff as the fallen, and an Athenian ally, who sometime after insultingly asked one of the prisoners from the island if those that had fallen were men of honor, received for answer that the atraktos, that is the arrow, would be worth a great deal if it could tell men of honor from the rest, in allusion to the fact that the killed were those whom the stones and arrows happened to hit. Upon the arrival of the men, the Athenians determined to keep them in prison until the peace, and if the Peloponnesians invaded their country in the interval, to bring them out and put them to death. Meanwhile, the defense of Pylos was not forgotten. The Messenians from Naupactus sent to their old country, to which Pylos formerly belonged, some of the likeliest of their number, and began a series of incursions into Laconia, which their common dialect rendered most destructive. The Lacedaemonians, hitherto without experience of incursions, or a warfare of the kind, finding the Helots deserting, and fearing the march of revolution in their country, began to be seriously uneasy, and in spite of their unwillingness to betray this to the Athenians, began to send envoys to Athens, and tried to recover Pylos and the prisoners. The Athenians, however, kept grasping at more, and dismissed envoy after envoy, without their having effected anything. Such was the history of the affair of Pylos. This is the end of chapter 12.